You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Kenneth Thompson defeated Kings County DA Charles Hines 3 years ago in part based on his criticism of some police practices, and he moved rapidly to address cases of wrongful convictions. Yet, as Village Voice senior writer Nick Pinto recently reported, the DA's office in Brooklyn has continued to rely on police officers who have been implicated in cases of possible perjury and evidence tampering. His article, The Incredibles, Judges Said These Cops Can't Be Trusted, So Why Does the DA Rely on Them?, appeared in the November 2nd issue of The Voice. You can find a link to it on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. I'm very pleased it has brought Nick Pinto to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What's been happening to cause judges to doubt some police officers?
Well, so the situation that I wrote about concerns a group of police officers working in the 67th precinct in Brooklyn, which is roughly East Flatbush.
East Flatbush, that's the part that's near Prospect Park?
No, it's further out. It's it's east of east of the part of Flatbush you're thinking of. It's a primarily Caribbean American neighborhood, and it is a neighborhood that historically has had more crime than many neighborhoods in the city. These officers were involved in a lot of gun arrests, arresting people and charging them with possession of an illegal firearm.
One defense attorney, Sarah Siegel of the Legal Aid Society, represented a man who was charged with possessing marijuana and handgun ammunition, but not a gun. Was that an especially unusual case?
No. So what happened there, that's the most recent case, and that's actually the newsiest piece of what I wrote about. In that case, Siegel's client was arrested on a search warrant. Police had entered his home and found marijuana and ammunition. The search warrant, there were several search warrants, each sort of building off of the other, but they suggested that police would find a handgun in the apartment. They did not. Those search warrants were based on the police work of several police officers who were in part relying on a confidential informant, also known as a CI. And so as Siegel, the public defender representing this person, started to look into this case, she came across the names of these police officers and wanted to know more about them. She Googled them. And what she found was that these officers... several of these officers were named in a series of New York Times stories from about 2 years ago, which outlined allegations, which outlined a pattern of cases in which these officers were involved, in which their testimony was found to be incredible by judges, legally incredible, in the sense that it was not to be believed, that the judges did not believe them or consider their testimony to be believable. And so...
In what ways?
Well...
They claimed they'd found guns when there were no guns or other kinds of things?
In a number of ways. There were several cases that bore a lot of similarities to each other. The police would say that they happened to be in the area when they noticed someone with a handgun in a transparent plastic bag standing on the street, and that at the moment when they were there, they took the gun out of one bag and put it into another, or they recognized the silhouette of the gun in a plastic bag or something like this. And then only months later, and many of these defendants spent, 10 months, a year in jail awaiting trial because they couldn't make bail. Only very deep into their legal process would it also be revealed that the police were saying that they were relying on a confidential informant who tipped them off to this. So some of the judges were reacting to the fact that these stories were strained credulity on the face of it, that someone would just be standing on a street corner sort of carrying a gun out in the open air for anyone to see.
In a plastic bag. almost advertising the fact that you have a gun.
Further complicating this was the fact that there was often a lot of there was really nothing. There was no evidence to rely on other than the testimony of the police officers. So DNA evidence either was never collected or when it was sought, turned up nothing. Surveillance cameras, which in some cases, you know, footage would have been available, that was never sought. So all of this hinged exclusively on the testimony of the officers and their credibility. And judges became skeptical of this in part because in some cases they would ask defense lawyers would ask for the criminal the confidential informant to be presented to establish that they were in fact real people and that they saw what they said they saw, and either because prosecutors resisted those motions or in some cases judges said yes, bring him in, let's meet this CI. And the police officers would say, actually, he doesn't feel like coming to court, nor does he even feel like speaking to the prosecution. So that also, I think, raised some suspicions. And then there was the fact that the police officers' own testimony in some cases shifted. They would say that they had received the phone call from the informant on their telephone, and then on cross-examination, oh, you received it on your telephone. Maybe can we see your telephone? Oh, well, he didn't call me on my phone. He called me on he called the other guy's phone. He never called me on my phone. For all those reasons, several New York judges, as well as a federal judge, said these guys are not to be believed.
The whole matter of a suspect carrying a gun has been a big issue in several cases where police have shot suspects, some of whom didn't seem to have had a gun. So this is a common thing that police will invoke when they're being questioned about questionable behavior?
Well, I think one of the reasons this has been such a sensitive issue, especially in East Flatbush, is that I don't know if you remember, but 3 or 4 years ago, something in that range, Kamani Gray was a young teenager who was killed in the 67th Precinct in East Flatbush by police officers. And the police said at the time that they shot him because he was drawing a gun. At the time, there were eyewitnesses who said that they didn't see a gun. I think this is one of the reasons that it's a sensitive question. If police can't be trusted to be making legitimate gun arrests, I think it speaks to an anxiety that.
My guess is Nick Pinto, whose article The Incredibles Judges Said These Cops Can't Be Trusted, So Why Does the DA Rely on Them, is in the November 2nd issue of The Village Voice. Another lawyer, Deborah Silberman, defended Jeffrey Herring. What happened in his case?
Right. Well, so it was Silberman's work that actually led to the Times story that Siegel ultimately found when she Googled these officers. So Herring's version of events was that he had spent a lovely summer June day walking his collie and running errands and was on the phone outside his apartment building getting ready to go back upstairs when, out of nowhere, several police officers came up, handcuffed him, took him back to the precinct, strip-searched him, and subjected him to several hours of interrogation, saying, tell us what you know about bad guys in the neighborhood. You know, where can you know, we're trying to get guns off the street. Where can we get some guns?
So they weren't accusing him of a crime, even though they'd handcuffed him?
Herring's contention is that they were demanding information and threatening to charge him if he didn't provide it. And Herring had some trouble with addiction many years before, but had gotten clean and really hasn't been in trouble for decades. And so he didn't really have anything to tell them. That's his version of events. The police version of events was that they located nearby, saw him standing outside the apartment with a gun in a plastic bag, transferred it from one bag to another, and that when he noticed the police officers, he tucked the bag with the gun behind some shrubs. Again, in this case, an absence of any evidence other than the police testimony.
But of course, that's what he's going to say, even if he did have the gun. He's not going to admit to any wrongdoing.
Certainly. So I think what aroused Silberman's suspicions, aside from just a desire to zealously work for her client, was the implausibility of the allegation that he was just standing outside waiting for police to roll by, and at that moment he presents a gun. But also, as she began to look into these officers' histories, she found nearly identical cases.
There's another story. Eugene Moore, arrested in 2012. His case was ultimately dismissed and sealed, but he'd spent a year in jail. What had they done in his case? Was this the same cops?
This was several of the same police officers, yes. Moore's case was almost identical. Was he the guy on the bike? I believe he was. So what police said in that case was that they had received a tip from a confidential informant that led them to Moore, and they found Moore with a gun, again, basically out in the open. It was Moore's case where in court, the police version of events of how they received this tip-off sort of unraveled, and the story changed very quickly under defense cross-examination.
And then there's another case, Terry Cross's, that is particularly troubling. The judge in that case, Dora Irizarry, strongly suggested the police officers had perjured themselves. Was that ever proved?
No, it was not. Well, it was, so perjury is a crime, and so... If one suggests that someone is lying under oath, perjury is sort of implicit in that. But that's different from being tried and convicted of the charge, right? So what happened in the Cross case, among other things, was that police said that Cross had been arrested on the basis of a photo array lineup where Cross had been identified by an informant.
Well, all of these accused black?
Yes.
Did Herring or Moore or others in similar cases have criminal records, something that would have put them on the police radar?
Yes, in some cases they did. And I think this gets to, an important nuance in it with this issue, that it would be very easy to tell this story if all of these people were had never had a criminal record, had never gotten into any sort of trouble. That's not the case with all of them. And so that sort of opens the door to an argument that getting guns off the street is an objective social good. If police don't dot every I and cross every T in the pursuit of that goal, are we really going to wring our hands about that? Right.
These guys are still bad guys in the eyes of the law.
Perhaps they are. Right. If indeed any of these people did have guns, police cut some corners to get them, maybe that's okay. But I think there's a pretty strong counterargument here that. Which was voiced by some of the public defenders I speak to, which is that we are a nation of laws, and there are certainly countries in the world where law enforcement pursues its goals without a lot of concern about the rights of the people they're going after, and that's an extremely slippery slope. And I wrote this story before the election. One might say that at a time like this, our concern for the constitutional rights of everybody, including criminal defendants, is more important than ever.
Well, I suspect that it's been just as true over the last, the history of the United States as it will be in the next 4 years. There's just people expressing a lot more concern these days.
Sure.
Nick Pinto's article, The Incredibles, judges said these cops can't be trusted, so why does the DA rely on them, is in the November 2nd issue of The Village Voice. We will continue our conversation after a little break. We're back with Nick Pinto. His article, The Incredibles, judges said these cops can't be trusted, so why does the DA rely on them, is in the November 2nd issue of The Village Voice. How many cases did the public defenders identify as a bit to be worried about?
Something in the neighborhood of half a dozen. But it's worth noting here that public defenders aren't really the people in the best position to identify these cases. In Brooklyn, people who can't afford a lawyer are assigned to either one of two major agencies who have contracts to do that work, or to individual lawyers doing that work. And so they're not really the people who have a comprehensive database of cases these cops have worked on. The people who have that are the NYPD and the Brooklyn DA.
You name four cops, Lieutenant Edward Babington, Sergeant Vasilios Adeniu, Officer Jean Galliard, and Detective Gregory Jean-Baptiste. Are these responsible for all of the cases?
No. So there's sort of a shifting constellation of officers, including one or two others beyond the names you gave. And some of that has to do, I think, with personnel turnover. One of these officers has already retired. Some of it has to do public defenders who work on these cases suspect that when police officers have gotten in trouble in court a few too many times, they know well enough that having their name on the paperwork probably isn't going to help the case, and so maybe they bring in a junior guy to actually be the arresting officer or something like this.
Is this just something that the public defenders think is limited to the 67th precinct? Because we could just be talking about a few bad apples.
I think
this is not like the famous cases that we had, Scarsella. He doesn't show up in these stories.
No, that's right. I think that's a question better posed to public defenders, but I would venture to say that while they're talking here about a very a discrete group of officers, I think public defenders would say that they have concerns about police respecting constitutional rights of defendants in a much more general way.
A theme in most of these cases is the use of confidential informants. Is it possible, even likely, that an informant might have an ulterior motive in turning somebody in? Are they ever paid?
They can be. In fact, there's a program specifically that pays $1,000 out for anyone who contributes to the recovery of an illegal firearm in the city, and there are mechanisms for getting that money to confidential informants anonymously.
Which means that if I were a cop and I needed $1,000, I'm not saying this ever happened, I might say a confidential informant was involved, give me the $1,000, and then I would just pocket it.
I think that's one of the things that people have been concerned about with this case, that possibility.
So can a person faced with prosecution get lighter treatment for providing information about others? Is that where most of the confidential informants come from, or are they crack addicts as they were in the Louis Scarsella cases?
I think there are many different kinds of confidential informants, but it's certainly true that one of the tools prosecutors use to build cases is to offer deals to people in return for their cooperation.
Well, why would a cop want to fabricate evidence? Isn't there enough crime to deal with as it is?
Well, so this is an interesting question.
I mean, does this lead to promotions? Is that one of the reasons?
So we don't know, right? But you know, some of the things we do know is that police officers have long complained that the NYPD maintains an unofficial quota system and that there is a lot of pressure to make numbers. So that's a factor. Certainly the fact that there are $1,000 available for tips that get a gun off the street could be a factor. And you know, to the extent that any of these people may have been guilty, there may be an attitude that how we do it doesn't matter, we're doing it.
When the police rely on confidential informants, what right does the defense team have to see the information the police and the prosecutors have obtained?
They have a lot of rights. So
can they interview the informant?
They can ask for a hearing, what's called a Darden hearing, in which the confidential informant has to present themselves or their identity and the reality of their existence has to be established. So that's one thing they're entitled to. The other legal tool that has been important in these cases. That brings it back to the initial case we were talking about with Sarah Siegel, is that when someone's charged with a crime, they're entitled to what's known as Brady material, any information that the prosecution has that might be useful to the defendant's case. And sort of as a subset of Brady material, they're entitled to any information about witnesses the prosecution is going to be calling or law enforcement whose work the prosecution is going to be building on. If the prosecution has any information about those people that might cause a jury or a judge to view their testimony with skepticism, that's something that the defense is entitled to. So when Sarah Siegel discovered the names of these officers, Googled them, and found that they had this long history, actually, I should go back if I can and connect some more dots. So The New York Times stories that Siegel found when she Googled them came about because Silberman and other public defenders, having connected all of these dots, brought them to the Brooklyn District Attorney and said, "We think you guys have a problem here."
To Ken Thompson or
yes,
not Charles Hines.
Right. No. This happened under Ken Thompson. We think you have a problem here, and we think you should look into it. We also think you should dismiss the case against our client. And they didn't. I think they didn't get the sort of response they wanted from the prosecutors. So ultimately, they took the story to the New York Times, who ran the series of stories. And it was only after the Times stories ran, which those stories landed sort of at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in New York. It was a time when everyone, I think, was especially sensitive to this stuff. Only at that point, when the press started asking him about this, did Thompson say, "Okay, we take this very seriously. We're going to look into it."
I'm speaking with Nick Pinto, whose article, "The Incredibles: Judges Said These Cops Can't Be Trusted, So Why Does the DA Rely on Them?" appeared in the November 2nd issue of The Village Voice. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about politicians? Have politicians representing East Flatbush, like City Council member Jermaine Williams, had anything to say about these cases?
I'm not aware that they had anything to say about these particular cases, no.
And Mayor de Blasio? Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams?
No, I don't think any of them have weighed in on this, to my knowledge.
Has anybody asked former police commissioner Bratton or current commissioner James O'Neill about this? Were you able to talk to him?
At the time that this first surfaced, the Times reporter who broke the first stories, Stephanie Clifford, who was then at the Times, asked the NYPD about these cases, and the NYPD responded that they were launching their own internal affairs investigation into these officers.
But we haven't heard anything since.
Well, for many, many months, nobody heard anything. I was calling the Brooklyn DA's office periodically to ask about the progress of the investigation they'd announced. And I was always told the investigation is ongoing. We can't talk about it. So there's nothing for you. And that remained the case until this summer, when Sarah Siegel picked up this case, representing a defendant where some of these officers who had been investigated by the Brooklyn DA and by the NYPD were involved in the case, and so that was interesting for a number of reasons. It meant that these officers were continuing to do the same work that had raised all of these concerns in the first place, still in the 67th, still making gun arrests on the basis of the alleged tips from criminal from confidential informants.
And prosecutors continuing to rely on their work.
Exactly. The other interesting thing that came out of it, though, was that Siegel was able to use the tools of the court to get some more information. She said, I'm entitled to my Brady material. I'm entitled to my Giglio material. You have to tell me everything about these police officers that you're building this case on. And that includes what happened to that NYPD investigation? What happened to your own office's investigation into these police officers? And after some delay, the prosecutor on her case said, there's nothing to turn over. We have no information about these officers that would be useful to you. And Siegel found that hard to believe because they, a year and a half earlier there had been these announcements that they were under investigation. So she went back to the court, and the court said, yes, indeed, you do have to turn this over. And so in this hearing, the prosecutor said, well, look, here's what I can tell you. These officers have never suffered any sort of departmental sanction for anything they've done. And as to the Brooklyn DA's investigation, that has been concluded since last November, and we found no evidence of any wrongdoing.
That was under Kent Thompson.
Correct.
Now we have a new Brooklyn DA, Eric Gonzalez. Has he been asked about this?
Well, so once I learned about this case, that was very interesting to me because I actually had asked about the case in the spring. I'd been calling periodically, and when I called in the spring, I had been told, I guess mistakenly, that the investigation was still ongoing and there wasn't anything that they could tell me. So when I finally did bring this to the DA's office and I showed them the transcript from this hearing in which the prosecutor conceded that indeed the investigation was concluded, a spokesman for the Brooklyn District Attorney said, yes, that's correct. It has been concluded, and we conducted a thorough investigation and we didn't find anything.
Deborah Silberman works for the Brooklyn Defender Services. Sarah Siegel is with Legal Aid Society. Are they public agencies? Do they have the resources needed to defend people like Jeffrey Herring or the other people we've mentioned?
They have contracts with the city to do the work that they do. I think they would probably tell you that they certainly could use more resources to do that work. All of the lawyers I spoke to are extremely energetic and capable people who are doing the best for their clients.
Although they often have huge caseloads, and we're talking about people who are accused and who don't have a lot of money and who require pro bono services in their defense. A common element seems to, as we mentioned earlier, seems to have been the use of confidential informants, and crime dramas like Law and Order often portrayed informants in a very positive way, the way that a case would be broken. So the public probably has a very different sense of what these cases might look like.
Yeah, I don't think anybody who shows up in my story is saying that confidential informants are not to be used or that they don't have a role in good police work. I think the larger point that people are making is that there's a degree of opacity in this entire process that makes it hard for the public to be completely reassured that the work that's being done in their name is being done ethically.
On the other hand, Patrick Lynch, who's the head of the Patrolman's Benevolent Association, and others have said that the police are victims of brutality father of a Dallas cop that was shot during demonstrations, is suing Black Lives Matter, and also the Reverend Al Sharpton, George Soros, and others for $550 million. So it depends on how you, which side of this debate you're on as to how much culpability you're going to assign to each side. We don't want to have people walking around the streets with guns. So we do want, at least in New York, we want to get rid of the guns on the streets. There's been a concerted effort. At the same time, sometimes you're suggesting we go too far?
Well, I think in this case, the suggestion is that we don't know enough about the sort of work that the police are doing, and that when multiple judges take the unusual step of saying that we find these officers of the law to be unbelievable in their testimony about what happened, and there are secret reports from the police and the Brooklyn DA that are not available for public scrutiny, that says actually nothing to see here, those judges were wrong, I think that's just concerning. As to the question of you know, the proper role of police, I think police do their best work when they have the trust of the communities in which they're working, and we're living in a time when I think, you know, many police leaders have conceded that trust is really lacking, and so I think situations like this maybe speak to some of the factors that contribute to that lack of confidence.
Nick Pinto's article, The Incredibles, judges said these cops can't be trusted, so why does the DA rely on them, is in the November 2nd issue of The Village Voice. We have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.